Previously on Nothing Borrowed, Nothing Gained.
There are innovations, right?
Cyrus McCormick, the inventor of the combine, he is credited with creating installment lending.
He's like going to try and talk you into buying this new car and keeping your payments the same.
The process of getting a loan approved is very intimate and very vulnerable.
Here's how banks get caught in a Texas hedge.
Not just sloppy, but intentionally streamlined, incomplete, I would say, underwriting of loans.
The government takes all the risk and the private sector makes the money.
That can be an innovation, but it certainly has trade-offs as well.
This is Nothing Borrowed, Nothing Gained, the story of ag lending, past, present, and future. I'm Sarah Mock. Have you heard about this equipment dealer that's selling pre-owned farm implements at a negative interest rate? Heritage Tractor, with branches mostly in Missouri, but a few in Kansas and Arkansas too, on some of their combines, they'll actually pay you up to 1% interest for the first 5 years of your loan. Isn't that nuts? 0% interest rates are one thing, but Heritage actually offers to cut farmers an annual check for 1% of the amount remaining on their John Deere finance note, which naturally had me asking, what the what? Of course, vendor financing is nothing new in agriculture. As John Blanchfield mentioned many episodes ago, some of the most prominent uses of credit in ag have been granted to farmers by equipment and input dealers. But Cyrus McCormick's original installment plans are, in most ways, unrecognizable from today's world of vendor credit, and more broadly, from all those lenders who fall in the broad category of non-bank. Today we're going to figure out how those non-banks offer these incredible financing deals, and how farmers should be thinking about them. But to do that, we'll first have to understand how non-banks in ag lending work, why they've risen to such prominence, and critically, what risks and opportunities they bring to the space. To help guide us through this conversation, we've got an ensemble cast for you, a number of familiar voices from recent episodes, and a few that you're going to hear more from in the coming weeks. First up, we've tracked down a lender who's been tackling this new non-bank space head-on.
My name is Holly Lynn Bunn, and my title is Executive Vice President at Growers Edge.
Maybe you've heard of Growers Edge before, or maybe it's new to you. But if you've gotten credit from a local retailer or co-op, there's a decent chance you've worked with them, even indirectly. Their standard business model is to help these kinds of retailers offer credit to their customers to purchase inputs. They do this by providing a good part of the capital, but also by supporting diligence work, specifically through what's called a scoring model.
For scorecards, you decide what metrics you want to measure, and then you weight those metrics and you run the loans through. And scorecarding means it's going to have a very fast answer. Basically, you want something that's happening automated, so there's no hands-on. Now, we do provide an opportunity for our partners to look at those. So again, it's not like it's blind, but the design behind it is that it's virtually provide an instant answer without any human intervention.
In other words, Growers Edge uses a completely or mostly automated digital system that takes in grower data and spits out a score to indicate their creditworthiness. And compared to the older, more manual and hands-on systems, this can be a game changer to these new lenders and the customers they work with.
There is a lot of value to that convenience. It's easy to talk about convenience credit and what it means to partners, but when you think of a portal that a grower can go to and not just have their financing, but also see their invoices and see everything that they've bought and see the plan that the agronomist has put together for them. That's a lot of value and a unique grower experience that they can have all of that tied together just in one location. I kind of joke about we all have trouble remembering all the passwords and all the places we need to go in today's age. But if I'm a farmer and I know I'm working with a local co-op and it can fulfill this, all of these needs, and literally going into one access point, farmers that are working with a traditional line of credit, that is set up to cover your crop input costs, as well as other costs that you might have throughout the year. And with the volatility that we have going on today, and if I know that I have a line of credit and I also have access to a direct line for those inputs, I'm probably going to hedge a little bit and give myself breathing room. So if the prices get way out of, you know, compared to maybe what they have been for like what we saw this past year on fertilizer, it can give them an increase in access to capital. Now, obviously, you got to mitigate that risk. So, of course, that side comes into play. But it depends on whose shoes are you in at the moment when you're thinking about that. But if I'm the grower, there's certainly an advantage to being able to have that. And then again, the convenience on top of it.
Ease of use and being able to access more credit are two big selling points for working with non-bank financiers like Growers Edge. And a big part of the reason why these lenders can and do operate differently than traditional credit institutions is because of their unique sources of funding. Again, we're not talking about depositor funds here or about government-backed bonds. Non-banks instead can pull money from pretty much any other part of the economy.
We work with a lot of different type of funding sources within banks and the foreign credit systems. We have access of funds through both of them, as well as private investors and investors in the company. At the core, we're a technology company and very much looking for a digital experience. So today we partner with funding sources that are comfortable and knowledgeable in that scoring landscape and putting it together from a digital perspective for both partners and for growers.
I'll note that Holly described these alternative funding sources as nearly unlimited. In other words, as long as Growers Edge and its retail partners continue earning competitive returns, their ability to access funds in the marketplace is substantial. There are many factors that set non-banks apart from banks in the farm credit system, but I think there's two in particular that are maybe the most important. To highlight those for us, let's check back in with an old friend, Jim Farrell. We've heard from Jim a couple of times now. He told the story of getting started in farming in 1977 and getting out in 1986 with pretty much nothing. This early formative experience with the dangers of ag debt led him to a number of different farm management jobs, and eventually to becoming the president and CEO of Farmers National Company in 2004. In the meantime, Jim also served on the board of directors of the Omaha branch of the Federal Reserve, and later the Kansas City Board. And in his 16 years working with the Fed, he's seen a lot of changes, especially in Holly's world.
As an example, Nutrien, which would be the largest of the ag retail companies, they're major lenders. They had a couple billion-dollar portfolio a few years ago, and they were pushing to a $5 billion portfolio of ag loans, for instance. So it varies from a seed company saying, we'll let you carry the seed cost, but the minute you harvest, we want our cutout first, or the fertilizer plant saying, I'll pay for the fertilizer, but then at the end of the season, you have to pay me.
Maybe it sounds like what Jim is describing here is just run-of-the-mill vendor financing. But what should be catching your ear is the scale. A $5 billion loan portfolio is huge. 95% of banks in the U.S., for example, have smaller loan portfolios than this. John Deere Financial Services, by comparison, is 10 times as large, with a reported portfolio size in 2020 of about $47 billion. Since 2008 in particular, non-bank lenders have become major sources of credit, holding an increasingly large amount of debt in ag. Why? Here's Kurt Covington, Senior Director of Ag America, another non-bank ag lender that we met a few episodes ago.
It has become incredibly difficult for farmers to work with commercial banks anymore because of the know your customer rules. A lot of this was a result of when we had the attack in New York, and it created all kinds of agencies making sure your borrower was not involved in activities in a banned country. And then Know Your Customer, Bank Secrecy Act, all of these rules came along. And somehow it sounds good for regulators. And they too say, look, we realize we're overregulating here, but our hands are sometimes tied. And so it has become very bifurcated because it then created a whole third set of lenders, one of which I belong to, which is not regulated at all. And we can pretty much, short of our investors not being happy about it, or perhaps the Securities and Exchange Commission if you're publicly traded.
Kurt here does a good job highlighting the increasing difficulty that ag borrowers have had working with the banking sector over the last two decades. Alternative lenders and non-banks have filled an important role, providing credit to those that banks have left behind. But there's reason to worry about the scale of these alternatives, too. Here's Jim again.
It's unregulated, and the interesting thing to me is it's unmeasured. So we have hit a record high debt, but that's USDA measured debt. That doesn't even take into account vendor debt.
The brass tacks here is the fact that this credit ecosystem is unregulated and unmeasured makes it very difficult to determine how healthy any of this debt is. First, the danger of unregulated debt is arguably that regulation in lending is there for a reason. Yes, for depositories, regulators are focused on protecting the funds of depositors, which generally means reining in the riskiest lenders and ensuring that individual institutions aren't stepping out too far on the risk curve in a way that's likely to leave FDIC holding the bag. But as we learned in understanding the business case for debt, regulation is also important for protecting borrowers. Regulation in banking helps ensure, or tries to anyway, that lenders aren't being predatory, that they're not handing out high-interest loans on unproven opportunities that are likely to end not with business growth, but with bankruptcy. There is no such regulation protecting borrowers in the non-bank space. But I'm sure I don't have to tell an audience in the ag world that regulations tend to be a one-size-fits-all game, which often don't work out very well when it comes to a diverse group of businesses that deal with a lot of different kinds of risk. Few have worked harder to understand the landscape of non-traditional lenders than Mike Bolgi, our Purdue economist, who's done a lot of research on this type of lending, and his work reveals how regulations in banking have left farmers out in the cold.
For example, agriculture still has a very strong focus on using land as a security position, as a collateral position, even backstopping operating loans. You'll always hear bankers say, we can always come back to the land, refinance that loan if there's a default on, say, the machinery or whatever, a loan, et cetera. So land is still a really critical part of the whole financial picture for the farming industry. The problem then means that those whose growth strategy for their business has been primarily renting land and don't have a very large land base, they frequently find it difficult to borrow money. They can get an operating line probably without as much difficulty, but particularly in terms of machinery and equipment, they're struggling because the lender doesn't feel they've got the collateral position that they can back up on if, in fact, there's a default on that machinery loan. And particularly for smaller farmers, that's a problem. For beginning farmers, that's a problem. And for farmers that have used rental as a growth strategy, that can be a problem. And that's another niche in the market that the traditional lending community has not serviced very well.
This example offers an interesting mix of issues. Yes, part of this is about conservativeness of banks, but another aspect is the regulation and how banks have to moderate their lending practices in order to follow the rules that protect depositors. Mike offered another interesting example of a situation where bank regulations create niches for other kinds of lenders to enter the ag credit markets. Though, as Mike points out here, these opportunities and the way these lenders operate is likely to change as interest rates continue to escalate.
I just had a conversation with someone within the last 6 months who wanted to get my reaction to a program that was going to be financing farmers who were what he described originally as Class B farmers. And what he was saying, these are farmers who have persistently and consistently done well financially. But they've encountered some unexpected event, like a major catastrophic windstorm or some weather event, like a disease that has just wiped them out or really profoundly hurt their repayment capacity, not permanently, but last year. And they would, in the long run, be very good customers. And I'm going to be very well secured. The idea is, how do I position myself so that if I'm wrong in my presumption that this was only a one-time event, that I'm well protected? And there's a strong focus on, again, having some collateral positions there. But traditional lenders, particularly in periods of rising interest rates, are probably going to be pretty hesitant to finance this type of organization.
Part of the problem for banks in this scenario is the recognition that though a farmer might have a history of good credit and evidence of a catastrophic one-time event, the reality is catastrophic one-time events are likely to have a big impact on repayment ability. In other words, however much a lender might like to ignore such an event, regulators will often not allow it. Non-regulated, non-banks, of course, do not have to comply with such regulations.
They still will provide by good credit rules, but they don't have to provide by the same rules that a regulated organization would.
Overall, I think Mike believes that non-traditional lenders, like non-banks, are playing an important role in the modern farm financial system. And despite the opaquency of the sector, he believes that non-traditional lenders are getting better at vetting their customers, which offers some confidence for those worried about the solvency of these portfolios. Though he's still concerned about the level of verification these lenders are pursuing beyond self-reported figures from borrowers themselves. Now, don't get me wrong. It's still generally in a non-bank's best interest not to undermine its own portfolio with risky or unverified loans. Here's Kurt with more on how non-banks manage those increased risks that they take on.
The rate's higher, the structure around the loan's a lot tighter, but in the end, you get your money fairly quickly. And for those farmers that are in distress, maybe can't quite qualify at Farm Credit or maybe can't qualify over here at the commercial or community bank, oftentimes those lenders will step in and fill the gap.
Maybe these farmers in distress that Kurt references just need a little stopgap credit to get them out of a tight spot. Or maybe there's a reason they ended up in the tight spot in the first place. Who knows? We, people outside of these lenders, definitely don't. This brings us to Jim's second point about the fact that this non-bank ag lending is currently unmeasured. Mike Bolgi, actually, co-authored a recent study that offered some of the best figures we currently have on what might be behind the curtain of the non-traditional lender balance sheet. That study estimates that about 13% of all ag debt is owned by non-traditional lenders, accounting for as much as 30% of all ag loans. This is clearly a significant amount. And the scary part is, we can't actually tell if these institutions are being cautious because there's so little transparency into these private portfolios. We have no way to tell, no third-party audits or confident confirmations that these $10 billion plus portfolios in ag are sound or not. I want to bring in John Blanchfield, our resident historian, to add a little perspective to this mystery, because maybe all is well behind this curtain of corporate secrecy, but also maybe not.
You remember that when the mortgage market crashed in 2008, 2009, there was a lot of talk about the shadow banking industry. And it turned out it was non-regulated lenders who were making a huge pile of subprime home mortgage loans. In the agricultural credit space, there is a shadow banking industry, and it's input suppliers, machinery manufacturers, individuals. It's a very large market, and some are very good. I mean, John Deere's been making credit available to farmers since old John Deere went out to Moline and made that plow. But a bunch of the shadow banking industry in agriculture is fairly new to credit and may not have the discipline that's required when you are in credit business.
From John's perspective, a big part of the problem here is the motivations behind vendor finance.
A lot of times credit is used by manufacturers and input suppliers to move product, not to finance the operation. It's to move the product from the shelves to the farmer, and you can book that sale.
Maybe this motivation feels reasonable, but with a little digging, John points out why this credit can be vulnerable. The problem is that when the same organization that evaluates a borrower's creditworthiness has a vested interest in them receiving the funds, in this case, so the sale can be booked, then it seems only natural that the lender would tend more towards approval, because the more loans get approved, the more product gets moved.
That credit can be vulnerable when you have either an interest rate shock or a price shock. Eventually, commodity prices are going to moderate again downward. And when that happens, you know, it's like the tide going out. When the tide goes out, that's when you see who's been swimming naked. And we could see that again in the farm economy, where today people are building up for a great market opportunity. They're borrowing and they're doing all kinds of stuff, inflation of assets. But eventually that's going to moderate. And that's when we might find some weaknesses in the farm credit environment.
Those swimming naked in this case are the overleveraged, the folks who are overzealous about the value of existing assets and overly euphoric about the potential in the market. And you'll note, it's not only farmers who might get caught out. Lenders, too, might find themselves in a tough spot. One of the key enablers of this whole new world of ag credit is something that none of our guests so far have mentioned. That is the unprecedented 2 decades of low interest rates we've just lived through. On that subject, I'm going to bring in former Kansas City Fed Chairman Thomas Honig. When we asked him about the precipitous rise of non-traditional lenders, he sees it as a rational result of there being an unprecedented amount of liquidity in the overall financial system. In short, there has been a lot more affordable and accessible money around in the last 20 years than there has ever been before, not least because of the actions of the Federal Reserve. In that way, he sees a pretty straight line from Fed policy to negative interest rate equipment.
So these non-banks, these so-called shadow finance, what is the source of their funding? Ultimately, the source of their funding is the banks, the very largest banks, where these reserves have gone to. So they make loans to hedge funds, to equity funds, to new kinds of sources that then make loans to these special, shall we say, groups that then buy whatever asset they can, and they create that risk.
Tom, I think, is talking well beyond the loan from the local equipment dealer here, referring to all the non-banks that have grown up in the ag sector. From Tom's perspective, the risk that all this unregulated lending brings to farm finance is its own systemic problem.
So what we're doing is leveraging the industry. We're leveraging all parts of it. And it will turn out badly in the long run as this continues on. And that's what I worry about with this shadow financial system. It all comes out ultimately from the banking system initially, and then you lever and lever on top of that until you cannot lever anymore. And then when the correction comes, it comes by in a very harsh manner. That's the risk we run going forward with this shadow banking. And I don't blame those who engage in this. It's the incentives that the market gave them. And it's the incentive that easy money gives them to do these sorts of things. So the sources of funds for these different shadow finance, that's going to become more difficult for them. They're going to have increased amount of difficulty acquiring that. And you'll see that reflected in future prices for assets generally as we see that develop.
What Tom is referring to here at the end is that the price of assets potentially could go down due to rising costs of credit. But it actually, more likely at least in the short run, will simply plateau. And farmers will be caught handing over their margin to pay interest on funds that have suddenly become much more expensive. And that's the thing, according to Tom. Vendor credit and non-banks might not be regulated, but they are inextricably linked to the banking sector, whether they like it or not. I hope at this point you've gotten the idea that non-bank lending is not a simple phenomenon. Its rise in agriculture has been driven by our country's recent financial past, both in terms of regulation and interest rates. And by turns, it has been both helpful and important in helping more people access credit in agriculture, and it has introduced a significant amount of new risk to the farm financial system. But what does all this mean for a farmer when they have an offer of 0% financing on a product or implement sitting on the desk in front of them? That's after the break. This podcast is brought to you by AEI Premium. AEI Premium is a website, forecasting tool, and community for those looking for an edge in their decision-making process. Here's David with more on what AEI Premium members get, from understandable stories to actionable insights.
So there's a recipe for chaotic weather, and the chaos recipe is warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico and this cool, dry air that comes off the Rocky Mountains. So you think about this line from Dallas to Oklahoma City to Wichita, up into Nebraska, into the Dakotas, where those two storm fronts meet. They don't average each other out. They amplify each other, and they create this chaotic weather event. And so there's these big thunderstorms that then roll across the plains from the west to the east. And I always found it interesting that these two things didn't average each other out. They don't offset each other. It's a bit of a paradox. But we have something very similar that happens in our decision-making. There is also chaos in decision-making when we have two things that don't offset each other, but they amplify each other, they feed off each other. And those two ingredients are uncertainty and a deluge or a torrent of information. And so we think about something around maybe interest rates, a big uncertainty here, or maybe commodity prices, energy prices, geopolitical issues. Those are big uncertainties. But then we think about all the information that's flooding our decision-making process. What happens is when we turn up the information spigot between social media and traditional media and people talking about other coffee shops, it's really hard to find the nuggets from the noise or the key pieces that are valuable.
To get the full story with AEI Premium today, head online to aei.ag. AEI Premium, be your own guru. Now, back to the show. To understand what's happening with that 0% interest rate loan you might be thinking about, we really have to get into what the motivation for offering credit is for a lot of non-banks. Kerr points out that there's some significant upsides for companies that offer credit that go well beyond making sure their customer has cash to buy their products.
That's how fertilizer companies, how they create a very sticky relationship. Sticky in a good way for them, maybe not so sticky for you, right? Is, hey, not only am I willing to sell you this fertilizer at whatever the price is, right? $400 a ton, I'll carry it. You don't have to pay me until harvest. Lo and behold, if you hadn't asked them to carry you, they may have sold it to you for $375 a ton. So there's always an implicit cost in doing that. If I'm the richest farmer in the world and I have all the cash I need, if I'm the Warren Buffett of farming, the first thing I'm going to do with my supplier is say, look, I'm not paying you $400 a ton. That's for the average guy out there that wants you to carry him till the end of the year. What's the best deal you can do for me at cash on the barrel head?
In that way, it's pretty clear why vendor financing has had such a renaissance. For one, capital has been cheap. So if the biggest barrier farmers have to making purchases is affording the product, offering credit is an incredibly valuable marketing tool. It gets customers in the door, product off the shelves, and keeps them coming back year after year, because the relationship is deeper than just customer-seller. Of course, relatively cheap and abundant credit has more consequences than just more lending from less traditional sources, especially when those lenders are selling products themselves. When vendors can offer very good terms for borrowing, they can also press up on their prices because they know that their customers aren't going to pay cash for it anyways.
My gut perception is that yes, it definitely allows you to increase prices and continue to sell product if you've got low interest rates. The question becomes, how long are they going to want to deploy capital at that level? Am I going to continue to offer 0% interest rates for the first 3 years you own your vehicle, for instance? So there was a lot of that one time. And in the equipment manufacturing, they did that as a way to incentivize people to buy the equipment. And with the increasing interest rate environment we're in right now, depending on how high it goes and how long it lasts, I think that's going to have an impact on it. So short answer is yes, I think it does drive prices up some by the ability of being able to offer way lower terms, because at the end of the day, it almost becomes, how much is my cost per acre?
What Jim is describing here goes back to the example we talked about a few episodes ago, about the car dealer who only wants to know about your monthly payment. In other words, the $500,000 or $1 million price tag on a new combine doesn't much matter. To your salesperson, all that really matters is whether or not you can afford the payment. It's worth taking a moment to consider what happens when a borrower can't repay a loan to a non-bank lender. I asked Holly from Grower's Edge this question, and notably, these alternative lenders tend to be in lower positions on the repayment hierarchy. In other words, their loans are inevitably a little bit more risky to them than a bank's are to a bank.
We file upon default. So basically, you're putting in a blanket lien if a loan is going to have trouble repaying. So do we account for that risk further up before you would get to that point? Absolutely. And again, that's part of that assessment of the ag retailer, and then you layer in the assessment of those individual growers, and then what does that particular loan look like? So our standard product is we're not attempting to get first position. We file upon default. Historically, we can look back and we can know that there are these few key indicators that's going to should tell you if an account's going to pay back, or the value of the land. Is it going to skyrocket or is it going to go down?
Of course, one way to wave away the concern about whether or not these farmers who hold all this debt will actually be able to pay it back is to look to the Farm Bill and the way that federal programs essentially de-risk these agricultural borrowers, both for banks and for non-banks.
Our crop insurance today, you're able to in most cases, not only cover your expenses, but also come away with money, come away with profit. If you buy the right insurance at the right levels, depending on what you're growing and where you're at, I know it's not the case with everybody, but that's a much more stabilizing factor. Just look at 2012 and the drought. If we hadn't had crop insurance, that environment would have been upside down from what it was. The crop insurance made that. In fact, it wasn't even a blip in the radar. It was actually a really good year. When you look at the overall farm income as a general sense, it was a pretty good year.
Those stabilizers like crop insurance and 20 years of relatively low interest rates have created a good environment in which vendor credit has flourished. This accessible and affordable credit has had other consequences as well. But Jim says the better explanation for high implement prices might have a more complicated explanation, but one with roots in the 1980s.
The other thing on the high inflation period that I haven't noticed yet, but I think we're on the verge of it, two things were really common back at the peak or the valley of the farm prices. Farmers were still trying to farm for taxes. And so I had a friend who was very excited. He'd gone in and he'd paid all of his interest off, which was substantial. But then he had to turn around and borrow living expense from the bank because he had no money. And he was really pleased that he had been able to pay that off. And he didn't really make the equation that this can't go on. And the other one was people that were not able to repay operating capital, but yet still were showing a profit. And so through their tax advice, had decided they need to buy a new tractor or a new pickup or a new whatever. And so that was driving purchases, and it still is today to a degree. So you get a low enough interest rate. I don't like to pay taxes, so I could buy new paint, avoid paying taxes. I could make this pay on a per acre basis, something that makes sense. And yeah, the manufacturer over time has the ability to pump the prices up probably quicker than if everybody was doing a straight cash transaction.
Taking stock of Jim's insights here, I think there's three big takeaways to hold on to about the recent history of non-bank financing and what it might mean going forward. First, the unregulated and unmeasured nature of vendor and non-bank financing makes it incredibly difficult for us, people on the outside, to understand how healthy those loans are. The lack of transparency in the non-traditional lender space is a risk for the entirety of the ag finance system, and one that shouldn't be ignored as more and more ag debt moves into this space. But second, that doesn't mean that vendor financing is a bad thing. It's filled a niche and has been a part of a suite of tools that's created additional stability in ag finance and agriculture more broadly. But there's a feedback loop at play here, and one that should make farmers think very carefully about, say, a zero or negative interest rate loan. Cheap money has made credit a valuable marketing tool, and in turn allowed farmers to afford much higher prices for inputs, especially assets like equipment. These three factors, the higher prices of inputs, the growing amount of unregulated credit extended to what is likely a higher risk pool of borrowers, and all of it existing out of view, that is quite the cocktail of factors to have prepared as interest rates begin to rise and the economy becomes more uncertain. The problem is, we don't really know how likely or unlikely these non-traditional lenders are to get into trouble in this new environment. And that fact adds a whole other level of uncertainty. But we started today's episode talking about negative interest rates at an implement dealership. And I think at this point, we have a better understanding of how exactly that kind of offer is possible. Here's John Blanchfield for an additional insight there.
When a manufacturer of, say, a combine advertises zero interest until next year, anybody who believes that there's not an interest price or cost built into that combine needs their head examined. Okay, so when I worked at the bank, farmers would come in and say, I can get this at zero rate for a year. And frequently I would say, take advantage of that. And then when the year's up, come and see me.
Holly from Growers Edge offered a similar perspective, sharing what she understands when she sees a super low interest rate made available to growers for a purchase.
Rebates from manufacturers is actually where that's coming from. It's really not the ag retailer. It's going to be transferring on a rebate that they have received from someone that's manufacturing a product and wanting to move the product at that level, from what I've seen. And I would say by and large, the partners that we talk to, we don't get into talking about 0%. It doesn't even come up. They do have the ability to price up a loan or buy down a loan. So if they have an individual that they see as risky, they can add an interest rate to that just before they pass it on to us. Or if they have a farmer that's buying a certain kind of seed that they do want to promote, or they have inventory that they want to move it, they can certainly do that very surgically and go in and buy a grower and make those adjustments if they want to. And it's that frustrating space that we all get in as a consumer. And any place that you go to get these ridiculous sales, and you're not offering this product at this retail price all the time. And it's the same thing. It's because the spread on the product is there with someone. And I'm just going to say it's often not necessarily directly with that ag retailer. It's going to be with the supplier that's coming into them. Yeah, I bet growers don't realize that. And do you have to if you're getting the 0%? Because is that particular grower that got the 0% actually paying for it in another way? And I'm not so sure they are. I think others are, but I'm not sure that grower is.
I think Holly's takeaway here really hits home. In short, money is never free, which means credit is never free. If you're not paying to borrow money by way of an interest rate, you're probably paying for it in another way, maybe directly through an inflated retail price. Maybe in brand or product loyalty, or potentially quality. Or maybe someone else in the supply chain is paying. It's worth wondering why they would do that and what they get out of the deal. As we were winding down, I asked David and Brent for their reflections on this whole story.
I don't know, Brent. Don't you think the local co-op giving you free money to buy their products is a bit of an innovation? I just feel like there's a lot of money.
It's just vendor credit. I think there's always been vendor credit for as long as you go to the company store. That's how all the miners went broke, right? They would go in and buy the claim, and then they'd have to buy all the products from the general store. And pretty soon, like, the guy would take the mine away from him after you'd done all the work and got almost to the gold, but not quite there. And he'd take it for your food bill and then go dig out the gold. I don't know.
Tennessee Earl Ford, 16 tons, what do you get? One day older and deeper in debt.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Oh, my soul to the company store. So right?
My family farm sits on an old camp town, and my grandfather tells a story that was passed down through the family that I think his grandparents owed the company more money every week because they had their cost of living for the house that was the company house and the company store. They got script. They didn't get paid cash. They got paid in script, which was a piece of paper that said, this is what you earned. And you take it down and they work it again. So it wasn't until the second child could go work in the mine at some ridiculously young age that they actually were getting enough income per week to actually get themselves into working off their debt at the company store.
I will say the one area where I don't see it so much as in trade credit, but equipment. I think equipment has got extremely expensive. I start to feel like there are more things, offers coming at me that are what I would call creative, in the sense of, here's a creative way for you to get all new equipment every year. And here's why it's a good deal. And you start talking to them like, we'll just set that up on a note. And I'm like, wait a second, why would I need a note? You got to do this and that. I'm like, no. So what you're telling me is that if I get new equipment every year, if I can't write a check for it, I've got a big problem. Because the end is going to not be good. If you replace your equipment every year, all of it, and you can't just write out the check for it, you're working yourself into a hole that you're never going to get out of. And they come up, I think sometimes vendors come up with creative ways to convince you that that's not the case and that you should do this. And that is the area on the equipment side, because the dollars are bigger and the stuff wears out, where I think people can make some bad decisions at times and not really understand exactly what they're doing because it's complicated. And I think there is some so-called elements of that financial innovation there. They're making people like, oh, this is a magic bullet as a way to solve this problem, and it's probably not.
Cheap and abundant credit is certainly a powerful tool. But if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you'll understand the skepticism around the idea that anything is a magic bullet. A decent argument that non-bank credit is probably not the magic bullet that some believe it is, the fact that the days of ultra-cheap credit are probably numbered. As interest rates in the economy continue to climb, it will become more and more expensive for companies and non-banks to run programs where credit is used as a marketing tool. And more importantly, if banks are charging 6, 7, or 8% interest, a retailer can offer well above zero and still make a pretty compelling deal. Over the course of the last six episodes, we have covered a lot of ground. We've covered some history of ag lending and how less has changed than we might have hoped. We've learned how lending works for ag banks, for farm credit, at Farmer Mac, and with vendors and non-banks. We've learned a lot about the unique risks and opportunities of each of these lenders. And we've learned about how they've worked together for the last 20 years, arguably during the best of financial times. But there's actually more, two more to be precise, big arenas where farmers and ranchers can go to fulfill their credit needs. The first, I'll let Mike Bulgey say a little bit more about.
The insurance industry has been a long-term player in this market. Much of the early lending in agriculture came from insurance companies. So insurance companies have this kind of fundamental structure here. They get proceeds, right, from people paying on insurance policies. So they have money that they need to invest someplace so they can pay out on the premium. But they got a lot of money. They got a lot of carry in the market. They have a whole lot of cash. They need to do something. So what happens is an insurance company will have somebody at the highest level say, okay, here is the portfolio balance we want to have. We'll put so much of our money into commercial real estate lending activity, so much of our money into farmland lending activity, so much of our money into all sorts of different investments. And so historically, what they've done is they have had a part of that investment policy has included farmland lending in that context. They don't make operating loans. They don't make generally machinery or equipment loans. It's all based on farmland secured with real estate as their collateral position. And it's been actually a pretty successful business for them. It's a relatively low risk. Farmers have a history of always paying unless they are absolutely in a terrible position.
Insurance companies have been lending in agriculture for almost as long as banks have. And though their practices and policies have changed somewhat over time, including during and in the aftermath of the 1980s, they've remained a big investor in the ag real estate lending space, seeing ag lending as a sector with competitive rates and relatively low risk given the time horizon they're operating on. We don't have a whole episode for you on the insurance investment space. In a lot of ways, insurance companies also act like the non-banks we spoke about today. But there's one other place that farmers can go to access loans, especially if they've been turned down from one of these many other lenders that we've discussed.
The Farm Service Agency of the United States Department of Agriculture makes a lot of loans to agriculture themselves. They also provide loan guarantees for a lot of borrowers so that if you can qualify, you can go and get a guarantee that tells the lender if this loan doesn't work out, the government is willing to basically insure it. And there's co-insurance and all that kind of stuff on it. But they intervene a lot in these credit markets.
Checking in on Ag's lender of last resort. Next time, on Nothing Borrowed, Nothing Gained. AEI.ag presents Nothing Borrowed, Nothing Gained is a production of AEI Premium, a website and forecasting community where ag nerds like us write, talk, and develop our ideas about the future of American agriculture. To learn more about becoming an AEI Premium subscriber and gaining access to a lot more great content like this podcast, visit AEI.ag. If you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and look out for Ag Economic Insights on social media at Ag Economists or email us directly at askus@aei.ag. This show is edited, produced, and co-hosted by me, Sarah Mock, along with David Widmar and Brent Loy. Special thanks to Holly Bunn, Jim Farrell, John Blanchfield, Kurt Covington, Tom Honig, and Mike Bulgey for sitting down with us. Further gratitude to the show's managers, Emily Rainieri and Sarah Hubbard, and the rest of the AEI team, including Jeff, Michael, Mason, and Aaron. And until next time, remember,
the good times never last.